You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
Human beings have been telling one another stories as long as there's been language, and probably even before that. And a huge component of human thought is devoted to the decoding and explanation of those stories, which is itself another kind of story. Human beings are storytelling animals, which means to understand ourselves, we have to understand the sort of stories we tell ourselves about ourselves and why. I'm Michael Farmer. Our guest today on Christian Humanist Profiles is Christina Bieber-Lake, whom you've heard on this program and many others on the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Her latest book, or not exactly her latest, as we'll see in just a moment, but her recent book is from the University of Notre Dame Press. It's called Beyond the Story, and I'm glad to have this opportunity to talk to her about it. How are you doing, Christina?
Just great. Thanks for having me.
Here at the outset, do you want to say a word about your other new book that we're not talking about today, that there'll probably be an interview about eventually?
Yes, it's in... on June 19th, it will be formally published. It's called The Flourishing Teacher, and it just takes the 20 years of teaching experience and kind of tries to be encouraging to readers. It was a blast to write, so easy compared to all the other books that I've written. And I'm starting to get some responses from various people who have been reading the advanced copies, so it's been fun.
I'm sure it's wonderful. But we're here to talk about Beyond the Story, your next to most recent book. You begin your book on story with a story about the way we tell stories, or rather, two stories about that. On the one hand, there's the classical and Christian story wherein we're trying to communicate beauty and goodness and other things. And then there's a Darwinian story about why we create art that you kind of see as the root of a lot of our problems in self-understanding. Can you run over the broad strokes of that second story, which has dominated the last few centuries?
Yeah, I was trying to set those out as simply as I could so that people could see that we're talking about two different versions of reality. In the Christian version, we're created beings with a purpose, the telos. And in the Darwinian version, we're biological accidents that could just as easily not have happened, that consciousness just somehow came up as an emergent quality out of the primordial soup at some point along the way. And there's no divine explanation for that, no divine intervention, no divine involvement whatsoever. And the word sociobiology is a term I keep returning to because it's the idea that everything cultural can be explained also through the evolutionary paradigm, through a Darwinian story, basically.
There's a kind of just-so story quality to a lot of those socio-evolutionary explanations,
oh, yes.
right? Like it's
yes.
you don't see it quite as much as you did 5-10 years ago, but for a long time it was, you know, let's look at a given human enterprise. Why do people write books? And the evolutionary psychologists would say, oh, well, they write books because it was a it gave them a competitive advantage to feel like they knew more than other people around them or whatever. And it's often these very tidy little stories. And I always wanted someone to write an article on what evolutionary psychology has to say about our reliance on evolutionary psychology.
That's a brilliant idea because, yes, of course, there's got to be some explanation, right? Because otherwise, there's no reason for it as an adaptive trait, whatever it is, right?
Right, so. Yeah. And everything boils down to that, right? It's all about the survival, the perpetuance of the of the species.
Mm-hmm. Otherwise, what would be the reason within an evolutionary framework for any human activity or behavior?
So is there a compelling Darwinian treatment of beauty? I know you obviously did a lot of research along those lines for this book. I mean, did anything the neo-Darwinians have to say about beauty make any sense to you?
That when it comes to natural beauty, yes. I mean, the story about why male birds, for instance, are so attractive to female birds, right? That's a oft-cited example. Makes sense. Like you want to have the brightest plumage, the most interesting peacock tail, whatever, so that the opposite sex would be attracted and then mating would, you know, increase. So natural beauty, yeah, makes some sense, right, within that framework. But cultural beauty, I think, is a good deal harder to explain why you would want to create a beautiful work of art, beautiful story, a beautiful painting within a sociobiology standpoint, I think. And that's why I wrote the book.
Right. And but what's interesting to me is, yeah, sociobiology can explain why the cardinal is red and why the lady cardinal is attracted to that.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a term for it? Cardinalette? but I don't. Does it have an explanation for why we're attracted to that? Why we think the cardinal is beautiful? Because surely it doesn't have anything to do with the continuance mm-hmm. of our species.
Yeah, I see what you're after there. And no, I don't recall reading anything. It could be that I ran into something, but nothing is coming into my mind about that, about
sure,
why
sure.
you
and
would find that.
And I'm putting you on the spot. I'm asking you.
No, that's okay.
Right off the bat, I'm getting off topic.
No, that's not off topic at all. Beauty is a central part of what I'm arguing, actually. Our attraction to beauty, our need to point out the beautiful that we see in the world around us is a big part of what I think is theological about storytelling.
And we'll get more specifically to beauty a little later, because this is something I've been thinking a lot about lately, and I'd love to talk more about that.
Yeah, I want to read what you've written about that and talk about Marcel and all the good things that you have to say.
Well, thank you. Hopefully they're good things.
Oh, they are.
Well, speaking of Marcel, almost all of the all of your work, this book and the other two that I've read from you, involves the concept of personalism. So before we go into your theory of art, I want to make sure our listeners understand what personalism is. How would you define that term?
Yeah, it's an important question to ask because people get confused all the time with the terminology, which makes sense because there's also something called personism, which is a completely different thing than personalism. Personalism, as I understand it, was coming out of the existential Christian existential movement that was Gabriel Marcel and Jacques Maritain and some other neo-Thomists of the 40s and 50s who were basically arguing that, you know, human uniqueness is important, that God made us with a purpose, with a telos in mind, that we're created beings, and therefore every person has divine value and worth. And that's not to be confused with personism, which is Peter Singer and his ilk, which argues that a human creature is a being is not a person until they reach an age of certain kind of consciousness and language acquisition.
Wow, they're almost exactly the opposite, aren't they?
They truly are. And again, they fall on that fault line between created being versus biological accident completely.
Where would you, other than your other books, where would you recommend people go to learn more about personalism? Because it's not something I think that gets taught in most philosophy classes.
No, it doesn't. And I feel like because of my original work with Flannery O'Connor, when I read these philosophers that she read, because they were big right in the 40s and 50s when she was writing for Catholics in particular, because I read all that, I feel like, oh my goodness, there's this huge treasure trove in there that nobody reads anymore. You know, Henri de Lubac or Claude Tremontin, you know, some of these that nobody even knows who they are, along with Jacques Maritain and maybe, you know, Etienne Gilson and some others that are more well known.
Part of the problem may be that you have to know how to pronounce French even to say their names.
It doesn't stop people, but, you know, it shouldn't stop people from looking at these great resources. I mean, those the two volumes that I read of Marcel's, you know, they're just really good stuff. And the way he talks about his own plays, which is something I'd love to talk with you about, his understanding of art, it fits perfectly with what I'm trying to argue.
Yeah, I agree with that. This notion that the human dignity is somehow at the center of all of our understanding of what human beings are, and thus all of our understanding of what human beings do.
Mm-hmm.
That's why Maritain blows me away, because Maritain writes about literally everything a human being can write about, right? But it all kind of revolves around this notion that human beings are created in the image of God, and thus
exactly
have this dignity.
Yeah, and it's either that or they aren't. You know, there's no in between. You're either a created being or you're not a created being, right? You either have that dignity of being in the image of God or you don't.
Yeah, you get Gabriel Marcel or you get Sartre, right?
But no, that's precisely the distinction that you get. And I tried to bring in the ways that Sartre really even defies his own understanding, sort of like works against himself by writing a novel, because novels have this inherent theological conviction that an individual person is important. And so he's like writing this novel in spite of himself.
Yeah, well, and we talked about this, I don't know if you remember, you gave one of the chapters that became this book, you gave it as a lecture at the college I used to teach at. And after your lecture, I came up to you and said, well, what about Elaine Robe Grillet, who writes these novels that have no characters and have no real plot?
I do remember.
I think they're called anti-novels.
Yeah, there's a lot of different names for them. Like Voyeur is one of them, right?
I've never actually read Robe Grillet. I feel like there's too many things I know I would enjoy reading for me to read Robe Grillet.
Yeah, I read it because I was working on this project and I knew I needed to read, you know, some of these novels, or read like Mallarmé, you know, these abstract kinds of people who are trying to defy, who are trying to do the opposite thing of what I'm talking about.
So what did you come down on in terms of what Robe Grillet is doing? Is it still a theological project in some way?
Okay, well, what I'm arguing is that it's an act of defiance that's only made possible by the general condition that is fiction writing. You see what I'm saying? Like, he can only do that because it's so against the norm. It's like metafiction, right? The metafiction writer can only write those kinds of stories because it's not what we expect, because it's not the usual thing we turn to for stories.
Yeah,
right?
to have the rebellion, you need 90% of humanity to walk the line.
Correct, and to turn constantly to their fiction for that kind of affirmation. And so the delight that you get, which I would argue, especially with metafiction, are kind of small pleasures, are just having to do with cleverness or the interesting way that you can subvert a reader's expectation. They're not the deep satisfactions and pleasures of what I would just simply say is mimesis, right? This kind of recognizing yourself in a character and the attention, the aesthetic attention paid to the character by the writer.
I know we've also talked about John Barth's, I think Title is the name of the story.
Yes.
Where it's like interrupted by It's essentially Mad Libs, right? He's like,
yes.
Insert adjective here, insert witty turn of phrase here. And one thing that strikes me about that, and I love Barth, but one thing that strikes me about that story is that there is a story that he's not narrating that's kind of seeping up from the bottom. Mm-hmm. So underneath this game that he's playing, that he's encouraging us to play with him, there is the sort story of the sort that you're talking about down there. I think of Barth as a very theological writer.
That's really interesting and does fit my thesis in a lot of ways. And it depends on how many basic plots you think there are, right? But like, if you have the structure of a story and you have the syntax, the narrative syntax, if you will, then you're going to be fitting in one of those plots. Like, how many do you want to boil it down to, Michael? 7 basic plots,
I've never really thought about it.
But it is an interesting exercise to kind of realize that there's not an infinite number of plots. I mean, there are, if you talk about every kind of variation, but basic stories, you know, hero goes on a journey or, right, there's somebody who comes in that changes things up. But, you know, it depends on who you talk to, how many narratives there are. But it would be gibberish if you couldn't find a story under the story.
And so I wonder, and again, having not read Robe Grelais, I wonder if when you read Robe Grelais, the story you're actually reading is, what is Robe Grelais doing here?
Oh, yeah, that is the story that you're reading. And how is he trying to subvert the typical, you know, story by having this kind of anti-hero or whatever that you are paying attention to in an abstract way and not the typical way? But like when I read, I think it's called Voyeur. I wish I could remember the title of it. That's the one that I've read. It was like, you know, yeah, I know what you're trying to do here. And I'm not kind of fooled by it. You know, I see how much this depends on a basic protagonist. Right.
I heard a line once about New Yorker cartoons that the appropriate response to a New Yorker cartoon is not laughter, but you saying, oh, I get it.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And there's a certain sort of metafiction that way too, right? It's just acknowledge the cleverness and move on.
I think it's almost all of metafiction is that. And that's part of the reason why it's not really something that most people just pick up and read.
Yeah, that's fair.
You know, at least I don't. I mean, I'm always teaching it to my students, of course, because we have a whole unit on metafiction and we read a lot of Lost in the Funhouse by John Barth. And
which is a book I will say it is
clever in a good way, you know, and it does raise the consciousness for students of the constructed nature of fiction, right, and of the things that we're learning in the 1960s about how, you know, we realize that we're not just like there's not just one reality. We're interpreting the reality each according to our own desires. We're constructing it a certain way. Sorry, my dog's going crazy.
That's all right. He's and, telling
a
story too.
Yeah, yes, he is. And the story is the mailman has come or something. But so, like, so they need to see how it fits in with the 60s and the whole post-structuralist revolution as a part of what the story is that these writers are trying to tell. Robert Coover, I think, had said something like, all men live by fictions. You know, that we live in some sort of told or constructed story. Now, I would argue that some stories are more true than others. They would not say that.
Yeah, but Coover we would do all live. That, would he?
Right. No, definitely not. But the students can at least recognize what, you know, Lyotard means when he says that postmodernism is incredulity toward meta-narrative. They're like, oh, yeah, I can get that. Like, I just don't want to believe in meta-narrative. And then there's always the clever student that's like, but isn't that a meta-narrative? And the answer is, yes, it is a meta-narrative.
You just imagine Lyotard coming over and shaking his hand. So let's get back to storytelling. You say, at its most basic level, storytelling, quote, involves intentional language use directed at a narratable event for the purpose of communicating something. And I want to break that definition down and discuss it piece by piece. So what theory of language is implied by that phrase, intentional language use?
Well, it's really relying on phenomenology as a kind of backbone philosophically for that. And phenomenology, as you know, is a big, messy area of philosophical inquiry, but I really am a huge fan of Merleau-Ponty, who I actually was in a class with speaking of Lyotard, Jean-François Lyotard was in a class, teaching a class that I was in, and it was on Eye and Mind by Merleau-Ponty.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's when I first started thinking about cave paintings, which is where I begin the book with the caves at Chauvet. But he was talking about Lascaux and how the pictures sort of are just coming out of the wall, and they had this long section about the carnal formula, like that it's embodied, that our language touches something that's kind of embodied out there in the world, the phenomenon coming into being for us. So I don't want to scare your listeners by using that word phenomenology, but it really has to do with the fact that you have thoughts about something, and that is what makes you have intention as well. So there's two meanings to the word intentionality there, if that makes sense. First, the idea of I'm doing something on purpose with intention, and then the idea that phenomenologically you don't think about nothing. You have to think about something.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I mean.
And it reminds me of something your late colleague Roger Lundin wrote in his last book. He said he was critiquing structuralism, and I think in particular, Saussure, that's his name.
Mm-hmm.
And he said what Saussure and Derrida fail to recognize is that behind whatever complicated web of language there is a human being trying
Correct.
To say something to another human being. So it all ties back into personalism, right? If personalism is true, the intention of the language matters.
It is everything, right? And so what happened in post-structuralism is, and because of the lead of structuralism, you removed language, you bracketed the referent, right? What it was even talking about, you just removed it and you treated it on an abstract level where all the words are related to each other in these binary formations, and they, you know, become seen in their relations to each other, but not to the person who's doing the speaking, and not to the thing that they're speaking about. So that level of abstraction necessarily removes the person from the language act. And I draw on Bakhtin in particular to return the person to the language. And that's why I love Bakhtin's, and I don't know Russian, so I don't know what this is, but the translated word is utterance. And when I ask my students, I'm like, what do you think about this word utterance? They're like, yeah, well, only a body can utter something, you know?
Yeah, it's physical.
It's physical, yeah. And it's speech acts. It's not, you know, the idea of speech, or even though parole, and I'm sorry to go down this French road, but you asked me. you know, this sort of like individual speech that is parole is still disembodied in the way that structuralists and post-structuralists tend to, you know, talk about it. So, yeah, I'm returning the body and I'm returning the person.
I'm sure you know the Borges story, Pierre Menand, author of The Quixote.
Yeah, it's been a long time. No.
For our listeners who don't know, in this story, this guy, Pierre Menand, decides to rewrite Don Quixote word for word, but he's not copying it out. He's actually rewriting it, and it becomes the product of his work. And it seems to me, though, that is about as postmodern a story as you can get, about as metafictional a story as you can get.
Borges in general.
But it's still getting to what you're saying here, right? That somehow the intentional language use that Pierre Menand is doing is different than what Cervantes did in writing Don Quixote the first time. And thus it really would be a different work, or would it?
Correct. No, it would. It would necessarily be a different work because a different person is speaking, a different person's intentionality is there, a different person's consciousness is involved in the act, right? And it's just amazing to me that we could have gone through this period where capital T theory reigns, that things could be so depersonalized and then have this kind of high ethical charge on it anyway.
Right.
You know, this sort of like, we're going to save the world or whatever.
It's so self-righteous,
despite
eliminating the human being from the equation in a lot of ways.
The death of the author, right?
The author function. Isn't that what Foucault calls it?
Yes, Foucault calls it the author function. You can't get more impersonal than that. It becomes a machine, technologies.
Man, we are tossing around the French names, aren't we?
Yeah, sorry. I teach theory, so I can't help it.
Narratable event is probably easy enough to understand, but I suspect that it's a broader term than it initially appears. What does it mean for an event to be narratable, and what, if anything, is excluded from that category?
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent question. And I tried to be, I tried not to go down the long rabbit trail of narratology too much because it can get really arcane and weird. For the same reason that structuralism can, because it's like this kind of scientific study of narrative, almost like abstract, again, abstraction. But the narratologist, a kind of bare minimum definition, I can't book one, just from David Herman, here are the things that make a narrative event. You know, it has to be a specific thing that happens to a person. And, there, you know, I can't remember what the different stages are now, but if you have to have like all four of those steps, or it's not really a story, right? It's not really something that you can narrate. Like if you just have a, I think I talked about the plum poem. This is just to say, if you just had, you know, Jim sat with Sally in a plum, you know, that's not really again, it depends on how much you want to unpack that and make it into a narrative event. Right. But there has to be something that happens. In short,
isn't that interesting, like, though, that if something doesn't happen, like in well, I forget this, the way you said the sentence, but he sits with her in a plum, like we try to narrate it, right? We're so bent on making meaning out of the world that we can't help but turn that into a story.
Right. As soon as we see somebody, and that's why paintings, how they work, right? And you can't help it fill the story. You just do, right? Because you know there is one. And that's part of what I'm arguing too. It's like there would be no reason to write that out, whatever you wrote out, if there wasn't a story behind it. Do you see?
Is there such a thing as a non-narratable event?
Oof, golly, that's a mind-blowing question. I don't think so. Do you think there's such a thing as a non-narratable event?
I mean, maybe in like the highest reaches of mysticism, right? You think about whatever happened to Aquinas toward the end of his life, to where he said that he everything he'd written in the Summa seemed like straw compared to what he'd seen.
Yeah.
In that sense, that would be unnarratable, but not really in the sense we're talking about, right?
It's
so far above human experience that you can experience it, but you can't put it into words. That's not the same thing as not being able to narrate it.
No, it's not the same. Same thing. And if it's an event, right, something that happened to a particular being, then I think it does have to be narratable. I think I'm willing to make that claim. Like something that happens in time and space to a particular person.
Yeah, I would think so. Because maybe if you just didn't even notice it happening, it wouldn't be narratable.
Well,
because
it's
the
narrative
is already to put it into a story of some sort, right?
Well, now you're getting to if a tree falls in the forest and no one's there to hear it, right? That's the same kind of idea. It still fell and made a sound, but nobody's observing it. It's still narratable. It's just nobody noticed it.
Yeah. Well, they're all in the mind of God, I guess.
I guess so.
Well, I think probably the most controversial part of your definition of storytelling is that final piece, for the purpose of communicating something. A major stream of literary criticism since the late 19th century, at least, has insisted that art is not about message. Do you disagree with that statement, or does the story communicate something other than a capital M message?
The story can communicate something other than a capital M message. I mean, some stories do want to communicate a capital M message, but I was trying to be as general as I could and still be particular. That the artist wants to communicate something, right? That creating art, you don't create art in a vacuum. Now, even if you were just creating that piece of art for yourself and you were the only one to look at it, it's still communicating something back to you, right? So I think it's unintelligible to write a story that is not communicating something. Now, that doesn't have to be a capital M message, if you understand the difference, right? But it is an act of communication. And that's where, again, I rely on that speech acts kind of idea, not just speech for the sake of speech, just floating out there. But that's not something that most people would recognize as what's going on when we write.
Mm-hmm. I think it was Frederick Buechner who said that the message of all art is pay attention.
Yes, and that is a big part of what I'm arguing in the book, right? That it's like the writer is the one who's saying, you have to pay attention to this. This is important. Or the painter. This is important. This is special. This is worth your attention. And in our economy today, when it's all about how your attention can be grabbed, right, where who can grab your attention, who can make you, who wants to get that little piece of screen on your phone, right, who can get that from you has won, that the artist is trying to communicate something deeper and something more profound that we would otherwise miss if we just lived in a world without it. I'm always asking my students what to do the thought experiment to try to imagine a world without story, without plays, without anything narrated, any fictional narration at all. And once they begin to really kind of dig into that, it blows their mind.
Right, and especially, I mean, depending on what you think of as fiction, right? So even examples in science textbooks.
Even examples, right. Or just story, making history into a story, right? If that wasn't somehow allowed. I mean, you can't even imagine it, right? It's impossible because we are particular beings who live in time and events happen to us, right? I mean, it doesn't work without embodied beings, you realize, like,
of course,
and it doesn't work without time. But that's an important theological conception too, in a world where, you know, Gnosticism kind of rules the day. As you know, this is one of the main themes of all of my scholarly work, is to investigate the ways that Gnosticism infects American intellectual and aesthetic life, you know, and messes it up. Trying to think that what's important is your thoughts rather than your body, right? And the things that you do, the things that happen to you.
Narrative kind of bridges that divide, right? I mean, narrative is something that starts in the physical world, enters your thoughts, mm-hmm. and then gets put back into the physical world so it can enter other people's thoughts.
Exactly. So, that's a good way to put it. That's why, for instance, Flannery O'Connor would call fiction an incarnational art. That not because it takes concepts and puts being into them, but it says being all around us just inherently has these concepts. And when you tell the story, you touch on that. You necessarily touch on that. You wouldn't have a story if you didn't, right?
Right, right. Yeah, it has to be connected to the exterior world, for lack of a better
mm-hmm.
term.
And it has to have a reason for being told, like something has to make it interesting. And that's, and to go back to the whole sort of sociobiological paradigm, they have to argue something along the lines of, well, that's the thing that made stories stand, like you had their adaptive power or whatever, that the fact that stories began to be recognized by survival instinct as important, right? However you want to put it, adaptive capability, is because you're better able to convince other people about the fact that some other people are coming in a canoe to kill your village. Right?
So, what a tedious way to look at the world.
No, I think it is too. There has to have some utility to it. That's the word I'm looking for. And so if you're a better storyteller, then you'll get your ideas across. Like, you think about the trickster tales, right? Like the Native American, for instance, trickster tales, or any, there's all kinds of cultures with different trickster tales, right? Like the gifted storyteller is the one who has the most power. Right? Even in a world where he or she doesn't have any power, if they can tell stories in a really powerful and provocative way, then they can undo the basic, you know, power structure of the jungle. Like the jungle, it's like the lion is the one in charge, but the monkey is smart.
Right.
Right. Yeah. That's basically Henry Louis Gates, you know, idea of the signifying monkey.
How universalizable do you think your examination of art is? You're talking specifically about narrative art, storytelling. Can we apply those principles to instrumental music or abstract painting or other forms of non-narrative artistic creation?
Yeah, I mean, of course I thought about that, knowing it was outside of my purview, but still important to the questions that I was asking. And I think intentionality in both senses of the word is what they share And so they are acts of communication, even if it's abstract art, abstract painting, or even if it is music that doesn't have words to it, I would still argue that the artist is communicating something, is saying, pay attention to this. But communicating without words.
Yeah, and something that cannot be put into words, right?
I mean, and something that by definition can't be put into words, right? Like, I mean, if music by definition, I guess, I don't know. I mean, music is really weak. Classical Greek and music are really big weaknesses in my own education.
Well, so, and that's why classical music is tough for me too, and I've tried for years, and there's a lot of it I really like, but you know, I'm doing this project on Gabriel Marcel, and Marcel loved classical music, and
interesting.
He said that he had that instead of a home country, essentially, because he grew up in Sweden, even though he was French, and I mean, he says at one point that that his philosophy and his plays are the islands in Greece, and the music is the water that flows around them.
Really?
So
that's so cool.
I think somehow if personalism is what we're after here, and Marcel is a kind of emblem of personalism, I think there must be something going on in instrumental music that is really foundational to what it is to be a person. And that's what he's picking up on.
Yeah, well, yes.
But I find it very difficult to talk about instrumental music as well.
Yeah, I'm just not trained at all. You know, I don't have the language.
You carve out a major role for love in the creation of art, which fits well with the neo-Thomists who make up your philosophical background. In what sense is telling a story an act of love?
Yeah, that is the main thesis, really. It's saying that people have value and dignity, and if they didn't have inherent value and dignity, there would be no reason to tell a story about them. And I don't mean people like capital P people, like universals. I'm talking about individual, particular persons. My favorite example of this is Flannery O'Connor's Parker's Back, where Parker, ordinary as a loaf of bread, is worth the story being told, because the transformative power of being made in the image of God is like the transformative, you know, power of the Eucharist. And to me, the artist necessarily says that. And this is why Bakhtin is so important to my argument, because he's saying, when you have that kind of aesthetic attention on somebody, aesthetic seeing, you are saying that I love this person, even the bad one, the Raskolnikovs. You know, you're saying this person is worthy of my attention and my love, worthy to die for, if you want to put it in Christian terms, right? That all of us, even as insignificant as each individual person might believe themselves to be, they're not insignificant when you consider them as created by a loving God in that God's image. So it has to be loving to value. I'm always thinking about my students this way, thinking about teaching for a moment. You know, they really just want to be seen.
Yeah, they do.
They, you know, and that's what I mean by love. Love for them is to see them and to believe in them in some level. That they're important, that they have value, that their life here is not just an accident, you know.
Well, I always thought teaching was a kind of communicating of something you love, right? You love Lydia Davis or whoever. And you want your students to love her.
Yes.
And when they don't, it hurts a little bit, right?
Like, it does hurt a little bit.
When you assign them a book, in a certain way, you're opening yourself up to them and saying, you know, this is part of who I am. Love this. And when they don't, it feels a little like they don't love you, even if that's not a reasonable thing for you to ask.
No.
Man, I miss teaching.
Yeah. No. But it really, it's recognition of each other as made in the image of God. And that concept of recognition, I'm borrowing from the Catholic philosopher, Robert Spemann. Recognition as a human being, right? As a member of the human species and therefore made in the image of God and worthy of our attention. And students, you know, when I come into my classroom, I want them to recognize that they are worthy of my attention and that this thing that this artist has spent time wanting to show us is worthy of our attention because it could potentially change the way we see each other.
You must change your life.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just like, isn't it really all about learning how to see the other? Isn't that what we're in the middle of right now?
Yeah.
As a country? Like, how do we really learn how to see somebody who is not like us as having value, as deserving life, you know, as having dignity?
You know, and Roger Ebert called movies a machine for empathy.
Yeah, well, this is not an unrelated point, right? Because there's been a lot of research, and I mentioned some of this in my book recently about stories and the empathy that they create, and that a kind of empathy that cannot be created any other way, mm-hmm. right, than through a story. You can't just have some kind of abstract concept, oh, you know, Black Lives Matter, you should love Black people. But if you have a story about an individual that you can relate to, then you see it. You know, and that's where, again, the spark that is George Floyd, right? It's like, here is a person.
Yep.
It became particularized, and it is now a story that we tell. A true story, but still a story of something that happened to him that showed that his life was not valued.
Well, and we're kind of fighting over what that story is going to be, right? Because you have...
Yeah.
You have people saying, you know, he was a human being who deserved to live. And then you have, I think, a disingenuous group of people saying, well, you know, he was no angel or whatever.
Right.
And
as if that discounts
story.
It.
Right.
Right.
But they're trying to disrupt it with this other story that is monstrous, in my opinion. I don't know how controversial that statement will be, but I think that's monstrous.
I think it's monstrous, too. And it goes back to what I was saying about Bakhtin. See, Bakhtin is saying you take even the most despicable character in fiction, the author still loves that character, right?
Mm-hmm.
Raskolnikov is just the one that keeps coming to mind because he's a Russian theorist. You know, Bakhtin was a Russian theorist, and that's a famous Russian character. And it's just like it doesn't matter what George Floyd had done before he, you know, was arrested. He's still a person with inherent dignity.
Yeah, I wrote an article for America Magazine last year, and I argued in it that what really turned the tide for the civil rights movement was not so much legislation, which is impersonal, mm-hmm. right? It was the mm-hmm. the video of Bull Connor letting the dogs loose and the tanks roll in for these peaceful protesters, that seeing an image like that, seeing a story told like that, how on earth can you take Bull Connor's side?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the power of story right there.
And I think that's what we're running into with George Floyd. Like, you read, there's an image I saw on Twitter. It was a poster somebody made of his last words. You know, it's him begging for mercy and crying for
mm-hmm.
his mercy.
I saw that too.
And
how do you
see that story, that dialogue, monologue,
right.
however you want, because nobody was listening to him apparently. How do you see that and not say, yeah, Black Lives Matter?
right. To see that, be like, what would it be if it were my son whose, you know, neck was under his foot? Or it was me who had the, you know, the policeman's foot on my neck, right?
Right.
Like,
right.
It forces you to have a kind of empathy. Because you get the particulars of the story. This is not about universals. It's about the particulars that actually make the difference. Like, that's what allows us to connect. You know, this is a particular person who just happened to be in the wrong place and, you know, maybe had done some things they shouldn't have done, but regardless, he died, you know.
Sorry to pull things around to politics, Christina. This isn't really...
No, I think
book,
I but... did that. I did that. But it is a political book if you think that what really matters is each individual person having dignity and value, you know, and that's a political position.
Yeah, absolutely.
It is in that regard.
It's one that you think everybody would be able to agree on, but unfortunately.
You think, right. And that's why I find the whole Darwinian story to be so depressing, right? Because within that, there's no real reason for anything but a kind of Nietzschean power play, you know, survival of the fittest. Why would it matter? Why should it matter how you treat other people? Right? If we're all just biological accidents.
Well, let's talk about some of the particular stories that you analyze in this book, and I don't think we'll have time to go through all of them, but we'll go through a few.
Sure.
You make the counterintuitive move of using Philip Roth's Everyman as an example.
Yeah.
That is a book that Amy Hungerford calls a resolutely human and materialist meditation on death. How does Roth's materialism fail to fall into these Darwinian categories that we've been talking about?
Well, it's similar to what I said about, you know, Jean-Paul Sartre, that he is doing everything he possibly can to try to defy by a story what stories inherently do. So I'm not even going to name my protagonist. I'm just going to call him Everyman. And then I'm going to try to pretend like it's just a story about the life and death of a male body. But then he writes a story that is anything but the life and death of a male body. You know, it's like his consciousness, Everyman, the character Everyman's, he's looking back over the things that he regrets. He longs for connection with his parents who have passed on, and the feeling of his lost youth, the mistakes that he's made, the alienation from his family, all of these things that make up an individual life that can be narrated, right? Can be told, and it starts with a funeral, in which typically what happens in a funeral is that a story is told about the life of this person who has died. This person made an impact. He walked on this earth. He did X things. He had these relationships. He made these choices that affected these other people. And it could have been otherwise. That's part of that's a really important part of storytelling too. Flannery O'Connor was the one who insisted that if you didn't have free will, you couldn't have stories. Right? Like if you weren't actually able to make choices, there would be nothing interesting to write about. And the more you think about it, the more that you realize that's a pretty profound truth. Like, you know, if we were completely biologically determined or Calvinistically determined, I guess. right? I don't know. But if we had no ability, right, to choose something different, then there wouldn't be any story of interest. And that's, of course, told. I just finished his Plot Against America, where he re-envisions a World War II era in which Charles Lindbergh gets elected president of the United States. You know, I mean, this is something that could have happened, is the point. And so Everyman, this protagonist, is this kind of person in spite of what the author is almost telling us to think about him, that his life is just insignificant and he died and that's it.
Yeah. I mean, how could, if you believe that, why would you write the story?
Why would you write the story if you believed that it wasn't worth thinking about? And in fact, for lack of a better term, learning something from, and what I think you're supposed to learn is you make choices, you make your bed and you lie in it, you know, is really what we learn from novels at some basic level, right? That our choices do make up our lives. That the narrative that we get to at the end of life is going to look one way or it's going to look another.
Well, and he must have known that, because why else would he call it Everyman and connect it to that medieval morality play, which is all about the choices you make, right?
It's totally about that. And as I point out in that chapter, there's some even specific language that crosses over some images that are shared between those. And here I think he's trying to defy that morality play by writing this novel, and he just doesn't do it. I don't think he defies it at all.
You have a chapter here on Lydia Davis, whom I mentioned earlier. She writes, for our listeners who don't know her, she writes these odd and difficult little stories that are somewhere between fiction, poetry, and essay, maybe even like fortune cookie at times.
Yeah, fortune cookie, that's good. I like that.
This is not an obvious place to turn when talking about narrative. And then you begin the chapter by talking about neuroscience, which is a discipline that is often or usually materialist and Darwinian in its outlook. What can Lydia Davis tell us about the way our brains work?
Yeah, that whole chapter was dedicated to this idea, this new area of research about what reading does to your brain, which is exciting, fascinating research. And I really dig it. I love reading that stuff, as long as it doesn't have a basically scientific naturalist starting point, which is to say that it's only something that happens in your brain. There's nothing else going on. It's just, you know, synapses firing. But once you allow, permit a non-naturalist kind of viewpoint there, or you allow theology back into the conversation, then seeing how those two work together is very fascinating. How a person's brain does respond to any given stimuli that we call a narrative, you know. And part of what I was arguing in there is how neuroscience shows that we are both interested in pattern, like the brain, particularly the right half, the right hemisphere of the brain, is interested in seeing how things fit together. And then we're also interested in individual words and little bits and sensory data, which is, of course, a left brain dominant kind of idea. And she's trying to do both of those things. And the stories play with both. It's like a cognitive delight. It's like a, you know, cheesecake for the brain. And stories are good because they entertain, right? And entertainment is a dopamine hit for your brain, right? So they wouldn't work. We wouldn't want to watch them. We wouldn't want to read them if they didn't give us some kind of little dopamine hit.
But it's a strange pleasure you get from Lydia Davis. I mean,
yeah, it is. It is. And it's like the metafiction pleasure, right? Some of it is just the cleverness of it. But I think more of it is the cognitive dissonance that you kind of have to figure out, what is she doing with this? But there's something super fun about, like, a game. Like, what is this story doing? And some of it's just flat out funny.
Yeah, that's
true. I mean, the one of, you know, passing wind, and it's just these kind of experiences that we've all had, where you're sitting in a room and somebody has passed the gas, and you're just, you know, who was that? And, you know, and she's just really remarkably good at telling that kind of story and making you realize that these are all these little narratable moments that we have and that show we're human, because consciousness is what makes us human, right? And I make a big deal of this in the book, robust first-person consciousness, a sense that we know who we are. We recognize ourselves in the mirror, right? This does not belong to any other species on the planet except for human beings. That it's not just I see myself in the mirror and I'm reacting to it. I recognize that self is me.
Well, as far as we know, it doesn't belong to any others, right?
No, and I make that very clear in the book, that as far as we know, because, you know, many of the philosophers that I really respect believe that it's possible that porpoises, for instance,
elephants, ravens,
right, that there's some very octopus, apparently very intelligent animals, you know, that this could be something that we could discover is present.
Yeah, and maybe elephants are persons too. I don't know that I'd have a huge problem with that. I like elephants. Have you read Joy Williams's 99 Stories of God?
No, but that sounds related to that 99 Creative Exercises thing, that graphic novel. Wow,
but
no.
It might be, but it's in that kind of Lydia Davis mode, that microfiction mode, but they're all kind of vaguely religious.
Oh, no, I'd like to take a look at that. I both love and hate her.
That was my experience of reading 99 Stories of God.
Yeah.
There's certainly nothing dogmatic in there, but they do what you say Davis does, right? They're kind of jumping off points. In some ways, Davis reminds me, there was this book, I've talked about it, not on this show, but on some other show once. There was a book where they gave you the first line of a story and you were supposed to write the rest of the story. And that's what Lydia Davis reminds me of. It's like,
yes,
she gives you this tiny sliver and you're really constructing the rest of it around that.
Yes. Well, in fact, that's so interesting, because when I was in graduate school, the internet was just taking off, right? And Updike was doing this thing where he started out the story and then people would submit the next line. and he would pick.
I've never heard of this.
Oh, yeah. And I did. I tried multiple times to get in the story and didn't get picked.
Bummer.
Yeah. It's so funny because I know.
Is that why you hate Updike, Christina?
No, it is not.
Do you feel like he left you behind?
No. But isn't that so weird that, I mean, it was just, it's almost inconceivable now to think of somebody as great as Updike trying to, you know, read all these different submissions and pick the next one.
He's a pretty big populist. That fits with what that's what I think about him. So you and I need to do a show, and I don't know if it would be on this program or on some other one where we just argue about John Updike for an hour.
Let's do it. I'm all over that. I have written that article, you know.
Oh, have you?
I haven't published it, but I've written it.
You'll have to send it to me. I'd love to read the article you're talking about. We're talking as if our listeners are privy to all of the conversations.
Yeah. I didn't mean to do that. I'm sorry. I just lost
it. This article is titled "Why I Won't Teach Updike." Is that correct?
Yeah. That's part of it. Yep. Mm-hmm. And I won't. And I stand by that. But yes, let's do that sometime. That would be a really good conversation.
Well, Christian literary criticism has historically been concerned with the three so-called transcendentals, beauty, goodness, and truth. The concepts come from ancient Greece, but they get picked up pretty hardcore in the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. I've been struggling with those concepts for the past few years. Traditionally, they're seen as connected, where beauty mm-hmm. is, truth and goodness are there as well. And I don't know that I can agree with that. Mm-hmm. And your chapter on Cormac McCarthy's The Road of All Things certainly seems mm-hmm. to suggest that they're connected. So can mm-hmm. help me understand how these things necessarily go together.
Okay. In my view, this is me reading Hans Urs von Balthasar. That's a mouthful of a name. And I got into a kind of an argument at a big Cormac McCarthy conference in Berlin with my fellow panelist about von Balthasar's view of these transcendentals, the goodness, beauty, and truth, because he said, oh, those are Platonic. And I said resolutely for von Balthasar, they are not Platonic universals, right? They're transcendentals. By which to say that because of the incarnation, and this is very explicitly the reason why, that when the form of God is seen walking on the earth, right? Like you see it, the beauty that is not what human beings would recognize as beautiful is connected to goodness and truth, like inherently connected because of the form, the appearance of the form. Like it's not some kind of like, oh, he stepped into this dirty bag of grossness that is creation, right? That the creation is inherently good. And the incarnation validates it, you know, just this basic anti-Gnostic theme that I've developed in all of my books. So they're connected because if you are telling something that is true and it's talking about goodness, then it is likely to appear beautiful. Now, this is not to say that you can't somehow have something that's beautiful that's not directly connected to goodness and truth. I don't mean to argue that. Okay. I'm not like equating them or making them identical with one another. Do you see what I'm saying? Like the Keats kind of thing, beauty is truth and truth is beauty, whatever that means. Uh-huh. Do you even know what that means? Right. I'm not equating them.
Oh, happy love. Oh, happy, happy love.
Yeah. Yeah. That stuff. That, no, because I think there's a romantic error and von Balthasar will call that out as an error of, you know, an anthropomorphizing kind of error. That the romantics make there. I'm simply saying that I think that they are, that when you see something that's beautiful, it touches on the good and the true, at least in some way, not equated with it, but it's almost like it can't be otherwise. And that's the way that Balthasar talks about it. Now, this is something I'm still thinking about, so I don't have it down precisely, but I really felt like with McCarthy's work in particular, this larger question of how does the beautiful language operate in that novel is best answered by its connection to the goodness. Now, sometimes that's goodness is known by its absence, mm-hmm. right? And that's, of course, Flannery O'Connor's world. But you can only call something ugly when you know what it should look like, right?
I just think about stories that are beautiful but not true. And the example I would use is the Matthew Arnold poem Dover Beach, which I think is one of the most beautiful poems ever written. And
correct. It is beautiful.
The truth, if you can call it a truth, at the center of it is that the world is totally meaningless and we just have to kind of pretend it's not. And I don't, I don't find that to be true. And so it seems to me that either you have to say the beauty is a false beauty, at which point I don't know what beauty is anymore, or you have to say that they're not connected.
No, I that's an excellent point, Michael. And like I said, sometimes I just, like, my head explodes when I start thinking about this too hard. Because beauty is such a contested term, you know, what do you, is it really a subjective kind of thing? You know, like, what is it?
I think I've come around on the idea that beauty is inherent to the object. I think I've managed to talk myself into being a metaphysical realist.
Yeah, well, I am, I think. Yes. And I am because it goes back to the idea that creation is inherently good and that being is inherently good, right? And inherently therefore beautiful. But fallen, right? So it can appear ugly, right? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, it really goes back to the being. Test case to me because it appears to be ugly, but because it has truth in it, there's beauty in it as well.
Yeah,
so it's
not
kind
just
of the
truth.
Opposite test case.
Yeah, it's not just truth as if truth were abstracted, right? An idea. I mean, truth of being, of being made in the image of God. In the case of the road, right? Like this man. His desire to keep his son alive is good and true, right?
You've got that kind of Gadamerian view of truth, right? That truth is what reveals the world to you, the
yes, atheist. Yes. Precisely. It's this phenomenology, you know, touching on that as well. Like what is revealed, what we discover about it. And it goes back to as well. I just read some other things that I've read since I wrote the book that talk about the relationship between beauty and revelation in that regard. You know, it's the revelation of the form of God in the world. And I find that profound. And that's what I mean by true. Like the revelation of God in the world is in being. So when I use the word truth, that's what I mean.
I got to read Von Balthasar, but those books are so expensive and so long.
They are so long. There's so many of them. I mean, my first several, like 2 months of sabbatical, I was just reading Glory of the Lord because it's so long. But, you know, on the other hand, it's what really got me started with the book. So it was kind of a starting
Christina,
point.
All your intellectual touchstones are Catholic. And I just want you to know that the church is waiting for you when you're ready.
Michael, no. We'll have to do another podcast about that. I believe that is something that we have to do. The true church. That's precisely why I won't ever be a Catholic.
Never say never. Von Balthasar and Marcel are praying for you. For your
you know I was raised Catholic, right?
No, I didn't
know that.
That.
I was baptized. So I was baptized Catholic.
Oh, so you are Catholic.
Yes, in a way of speaking, one could argue that I never was not Catholic.
I think the Pope actually claims jurisdiction over everyone who's been baptized, whether they were baptized.
Oh, I'm sure he does. Yeah, I'm sure he does.
Well, I've been steering this conversation so far, but here on Christian Humanist Profiles, in the spirit of hospitality, we like to give our guests the final word after we badger them about their religious beliefs. What haven't we talked about here that you'd like our listeners to know?
It's okay, because Eugene Genovese used to tell me that I should burn at the stake for being a Protestant. he was such a funny guy. What do I want? I want people to read novels and think about how they work in this regard. For instance, we haven't talked about the last chapter, which is about two graphic novels. One of them called Here by Richard McGuire. It's one of my favorite books, and it's a graphic novel where, have you read this, Michael?
I haven't, which is why I didn't ask about it. Cause I didn't think I could
totally
have a conversation
fine.
About it.
I just want people to read it, like to get it from the library or whatever, because it's panels are a spread. The whole page is a spread, and there are windows inside a spread. So like the spread will be say 1689, and then another window will be 2017, another window will be 1950, and it'll just show different things that happened in that exact spot in somebody's living room, who happens to be the writer's house where he grew up. And so that's what's meant by here. So it's taking a spot and kind of giving you windows into everything that happened on that spot. This is all fictional, but still could have happened on that spot in a 35,000 year stretch, and goes into the future as well. And it just blows your mind to think about how life affirming that really is, right? Because there's no aesthetic interest if there's not humans there, right? I mean, there's some, but if it was just a ditch, you wouldn't be like captivated for, you know, these many pages.
Unless you tried to see, make a story out of whatever animal life
right,
was there.
Animals that were there.
And then
whatever.
You would only do it by turning them into humans.
Right. You would have to anthropomorphize them in some way. Right. So you get this window into why we pay attention to just an everyday person. Like, this is just an everyday house in New Jersey, you know? It was built, it was torn down, later the area flooded, and, you know, all this other stuff goes on with it. And it's just riveting. And I think that makes the point that I most want to make, is just asking why we want to pay that kind of attention, and then realizing it's because God holds us in his hands. And I end the book with Julian of Norwich, you know, that the hazelnut image. Mm-hmm. God holds us in his hands. All things are going to be well because he has made us, and he holds us and looks down on us. And that look is a look of love.
What a beautiful way to end.
Indeed.
We've been talking with Christina Bieber-Lake about her recent book, Beyond the Story, which is available now from Notre Dame University Press. We'll have a link on the website, christianhumanist.org, where you can buy that book directly from the publisher, because I'm sure you get more royalties that way. Is that right?
I don't know.
I don't like to support Amazon.
No, great. Go directly to the publisher.
You can hear Christina on the Christian Feminist podcast and on the other show on this network, The Core Curriculum, where I know that you've signed up for some episodes on The Odyssey, which will be airing a few months from now, probably. So I'm sure our listeners look forward to hearing those. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Christina.
My pleasure.